It's a movement, but it's about people. Be the People is about we the people joining forces to reclaim and reshape the best of our nation's time-treasured traditions. Each week, we offer insightful interviews with movers and shakers from all different spheres of life. And now, please welcome Dr. Carol Swain.
Welcome to the Be the People podcast. Our issue today is presidential politics. Will President Trump be reelected to a second term? Right now, when we look at the Democratic side, there are lots of people in the race and lots of unknowns when it comes to potential Republican challengers. What will the field look like in a few months? And what will President Trump have to do to win a second term? Joining me today is a guest that lives and breathes politics. It's Steve Gill, a conservative talk radio host in Nashville, Tennessee, where I live, who is the political editor for several online newspapers. Among these are the Tennessee and Ohio Star. So join me in welcoming Steve Gill to the Be the People show.
Hey, Carol, good to be with you again.
It's great having you on this show. And I know that you have been following the presidential politics really closely, and you were quite involved in the last election. So looking at what's taking place today, what is your perspective on the presidential field and the difficulty or ease of a reelection for President Trump?
Well, I think, first of all, the Democrats continue to expand the number of candidates, but not necessarily the quality of candidates that are seeking the Democratic nomination for the presidency. A couple more members of Congress in just the last weeks or so have announced that they're intending to run and announced their candidacy. And several of them are people that nobody even in Congress has any awareness of because they've had such a blank slate record in Congress, and yet they're wanting to, I guess, try to throw their name out in the hope that maybe lightning will strike and they'll end up as the Democrats' nominee. Right now, it's interesting that the two leaders among the Democrats, Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, who's expected to get in this week as we're taping this show, both of them have been failed presidential candidates. Bernie Sanders couldn't defeat Hillary Clinton, who may be the worst presidential candidate on either side of the aisle in a century. He couldn't beat her, but he's going to run again. He has very determined supporters, but they're a relatively small percentage of supporters. It's enough to make him one of the leading contenders in the Democratic primary right now, but not enough to carry him, I don't think, to the White House. And then you've got Joe Biden, who will be making, when he makes his announcement, his third run for the presidency after two failed attempts previously. And in his mid-70s, I'm not sure that he's bringing the vim and vigor that Democrats seem to be seeking. And then you look at the rest of the cast of characters that are running for the Democratic nomination. They are appealing to certain ideological bases or identity bases. You've got Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, whose main claim to fame is that he's gay and married to a man.
I'd like to stop you with Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden. It seems to me that they have a problem, according to the Democratic activists. They happen to be old white men that are heterosexual.
Yeah, they're both creepy and cranky, and one's creepy, one's cranky. You can decide which one is which. It does not fit the identity push that the Democrats are seeking. Again, when they're looking at youthful vigor or a gay candidate like Pete Buttigieg or Kamala Harris, a woman of color, they want identity politics, and yet they're two front runners at this point. Or as you said, two old white males. Right now, Biden and Bernie Sanders are leading because they have higher name recognition than the rest of the characters that are running. That'll change over time as some of the candidates raise enough money, raise their profile. But I think you're also going to see kind of an ebb and flow. A candidate will get their time in the spotlight and perhaps fail miserably and kind of move back into the pack. We saw that a little bit with Beto O'Rourke. He was the next big thing when he was announcing and letting us watch the video of him going to the dentist And yet he's kind of fallen by the wayside as Democrat voters take a look and decide, oh, I'm not sure about him, and then they move to the next one. Right now, Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, is getting his time in the spotlight. Elizabeth Warren has had her time. Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar have had their time in the spotlight in the past, and they haven't captivated the Democrat voters, at least at this point, in a way that has them kind of moving into front-runner status. So you're right, Carol, that at this point, you know, the Democrats who claim they want a new face, a youthful vigor to their campaign, have two old, white, cranky, creepy guys leading the pack.
Now, there's no real advantage to being the front runner at this point. Is that correct, or am I wrong here?
Well, it may help you raise money. I mean, people like to bet on a winner, and yet when you look at some of these other candidates, they're raising a lot of money from again the specific identity groups that may be supporting them. But you have not only the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary very early in the process that will winnow the field down pretty dramatically, but the Democrats have also moved California up early in their process of determining delegates to their convention who will ultimately pick their nominee. And it is extraordinarily expensive to campaign in California, which is why Kamala Harris is counting on the fact that she has an advantage in California. She's been elected attorney general. She's been elected to the U.S. Senator position from California. She's counting on the fact that she can do more with less money there than might otherwise be expected of some of these other candidates, because other candidates looking to play in California are going to find it too expensive to play, and the same thing is going to be true in places like Florida and Texas and other major states. So money will matter, and a lot of these folks that are running on the Democrat side are burning up their money faster than they're raising it.
Well, let me ask you about your pulse on the country and how far the Democratic Party leans left now. Do you think that they have enough support or they can deceive enough Americans that it won't matter that they are out of the mainstream?
I think they're moving further and further to the left and further from mainstream America. One of the things I think folks should really pay close attention to is the polling that we're seeing nationally. Most of the polls that you're seeing are national polls, what the people from New York City to San Francisco think. Well, a lot of those states don't really matter in terms of presidential politics because there are only going to be about 17 battleground states that will ultimately determine who gets elected president, who controls the Senate, who controls the Congress. So you may have a large number of voters in, say, New York or California who overwhelmingly are left-wing and support the most leftist candidate in the pool for the Democrats. But the race is going to be determined by how those blue-collar Democrats, how those Catholic-voting Democrats in places like Ohio and Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin decide to vote. That flyover country where Hillary Clinton lost, which is what cost her the presidency. And keep in mind that even in New York State, where Hillary Clinton got the electoral votes, ran up the score there, outside of New York City itself, Hillary Clinton only won the state of New York by about 870 votes. So even within some of these left-wing states, like California and New York, there are pockets of where they get their pool of votes, not
yes.
necessarily the overwhelming votes in that state. And I think that's true when you look across the country.
Yes. We're going to take a break.
The Out Loud Perspective awaits you in life, love, politics, a healthy lifestyle, your faith, personal development, and living an out loud life on AmericaOutloud.com. Blitzer News and Entertainment Network, where you can listen 24/7 on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Are you wondering what we can do about immigration? Then get your copy of my newly released book, Debating Immigration, the second edition, available at Amazon, Cambridge University Press, and all major booksellers. I'm back with my guest, Steve Gill, and we're talking about all things presidential politics, especially the 2020 elections and what's going to happen or what might happen with President Trump and his reelection bid. Steve, looking at the politics today and all the back and forth from the Democrats about impeachment of President Trump, do you think they will inflict a blow that will carry into 2020, or that this is just noise that will cause the average voter to turn away from the party, their party, the Democrats?
I think they're going to land a blow, but I think it's going to be a self-inflicted wound on the impeachment issue. We saw that when the Republicans overreached and impeached President Clinton, and it cost them the next time the voters had a chance to respond. Newt Gingrich said it was one of the biggest mistakes of his time as Speaker to allow the impeachment to proceed, because it hurt the Republicans much more than it did the Democrats. And I think we're already seeing a lot of signs that this impeachment push by the far-left extreme in the Democratic Party is not going to be helpful to Democrats, both in terms of keeping control of the Congress, because a lot of the members of Congress who got elected a year ago were elected in districts that lean right, lean to the Republicans, and in some cases were districts that President Trump carried. So as they move further to the left, they alienate themselves from their own base of voters for getting reelected and perhaps putting control of the House back into the Republican hands. I think the other thing to look at on this impeachment push is it is not what the American people are wanting. They want Congress to deal with immigration and health care and the economy. And the more they talk about things that don't matter to those voters, the more they distance themselves from the likelihood of a win in the 2020 election, certainly in the presidency, but also in terms of perhaps taking control of the Senate or keeping the House. I would say two issues really are helping President Trump, and I think put him in a good position to win re-election. First of all, again, the Democrats are going to continue to shoot themselves in the foot, repeatedly reload and reshoot themselves if they keep pushing impeachment. Yeah.
Don't you think that the reason that they are pushing impeachment is just to prevent the president from enacting his agenda? It's not really about impeachment. It's to block him from making change.
I think that's a large part of it, but I think a bigger part is that their left-wing extremist base is demanding it. I mean, they have Trump derangement syndrome. Even after the Mueller report found that there was no collusion and no basis to prosecute for obstruction, they're still screaming and pitching a fit, demanding impeachment. Even Steny Hoyer, who's the majority leader for the Democrats in the House, came out and said, look, impeachment's not on the table. It's not what we should be doing. It'll be a waste of time. And then he immediately got threatened with primary opposition and immediately flip-flopped on the issue. And the same thing's happening to other moderate, sensible, rational Democrats. There are a few, not many, but they're being pulled to the left by the radical extremists that are listening to the Ilhan Omars and the Ocasio-Cortezes and the other extremists in the Democratic Party who keep pulling them in the direction of endless investigations rather than actually getting anything done. Again, the number one issue to most Americans is immigration. And as we see the continued flood of illegals pouring across the border, flowing into communities, taking jobs from Americans, climbing onto the backs of American taxpayers, bringing disease into this country, bringing violence into this country, Americans want something done, and the Democrats are caterwauling about impeachment that doesn't solve the issue that they see as the number one issue. Americans are concerned about health care costs. They're concerned about the economy and whether or not the gains we've made now will be sustained. And Democrats are not talking about that. President Trump is producing results and is trying to deal with immigration. And I think those two issues, the economy and immigration, put him in a good position for reelection.
Now, if you were President Trump's close political advisor and you had power to get him to follow your advice, what would you be telling him right now?
I think I would keep that focus on immigration and on securing the border and on the economy. I'm talking about the continued gains we've made. Strike a deal with China that will, again, relieve the tariff barriers, open up more opportunities for U.S. goods and services into China, which will give another boost to the economy. Raise wages, continue to reduce the tax burden and the regulatory burden, and keep the economy moving in the right direction. The other issue that I would encourage him to focus upon is one that I think helped win the election for him 2 years ago, and that is the issue of abortion. We've seen in New York the Democrats push and cheer, killing unborn babies moments before birth. We've seen the Democrat governor of Virginia talk about killing them after birth.
Yes.
And we've seen a move in polling of of even pro-abortion Democrats saying, no, that third trimester when a baby is healthy and viable, that's too far. And I think if the president recognizes that one of the things that won him the last election was that last debate in Nevada, in Las Vegas, where he was determinedly pro-life and Hillary Clinton was absolutely pro-abortion, it swung votes, particularly among the Catholic community, Catholic voters, pro-life Catholics in places like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin. President Trump won those states by a narrow margin, only 20 to 30,000 votes in Pennsylvania. That Catholic vote that swung to him because of his pro-life position was the difference then, and I think it has the prospect to not only energize a Republican, evangelical, and Catholic base in those key battleground states this time, but also maybe pull off some Democrats who are appalled at how far, how pro-abortion, how pro-baby killing, even after birth, the Democrats have moved to cater to their pro-abortion base.
I think it's so unfortunate that today, if you want to run for office as a Democrat, they expect you, you know, to endorse all of their views. There doesn't seem to be a place for a moderate Democrat, or I believe there may be a few pro-life Democrats, but they are far and few in between.
You know, what's interesting, Carol, is that particularly in the black community, there is a rising tide of pro-life African-American voters who have been so wedded to the Democratic Party. I mean, 92% of African-Americans tend to vote Democrat in presidential elections or in most statewide elections. And yet you're starting to see Democrats, black Democrats, recognize that the overwhelming majority of babies that are being killed in the abortion clinics are black children. More black babies are aborted in New York City than are born in New York City. And I think you're starting to see some African-American voters and leaders start to pull away from the Democratic Party on that issue. They may not become Republicans, but they may stay home and they may avoid voting for Democrats who are so adamantly pro-abortion. We just saw in North Carolina, the Democrat governor vetoed an infanticide bill to protect babies from being killed after birth. Only six Democrats in the state voted to override that veto. And you know what all six had in common? They were all black Democrats. There is a wedge opportunity, I think, among black pro-life Christian voters to pull them away from the pro-abortion Democratic Party. I think if Republicans will reach out and make their case in that way, maybe put some more black leaders talking about the pro-life agenda rather than just white leadership, I think there's an opportunity to pull some pro-life Christian black voters away from the Democratic Party on that one issue.
I agree, and there are plenty of black conservatives, men and women, who are out there talking about the abortion issue. They don't always get the support that you would expect they would get from the Republican Party, but they are out there, and I believe that black men are standing up on this issue more than black women because of the feminist politics of the Democratic Party. Puts a lot of pressure on educated black women to go along with the agenda.
Well, you see the same thing among kind of that suburban, educated, white female voter as well. It's that sense that you have to be true to your gender by supporting the killing of unborn babies. And, you know, I would just remind people that half of those unborn babies that are aborted are female. They're women. There's young girls that are being stopped before they can even live. And to me, if you're a true feminist, you want to give those unborn female babies a chance at life.
And Steve, what do you think about the Republicans that are making sounds as if they might run against the president? How many of them do you think will actually take him on?
Yeah, you've got Bill Weld, the former governor of Massachusetts, you know, who was an Obama supporter. He is an anti-Trumper. You know, I don't think you're going to see many gains among those. I don't think they're going to raise significant amounts of money. I think they're going to get some noise. I think the mainstream media that wants to hurt Trump will give them some attention. But I don't think they're going to get any traction in the Republican primary and nominating process. For example, we just did a poll with the Tennessee Star, and folks can find it at TennesseeStar.com, on where Republican primary voters in Tennessee are on a variety of issues, including their approval and disapproval of different candidates. President Trump has an approval rating of 87.7% among likely Republican primary voters in Tennessee.
Wow.
I think you're going to see that same kind of support level in other states. the Republican Party, with a lot of Trump voters who've been brought into the Republican Party, who weren't voting Republican 4 years or 8 years ago, Republican primary voters are pro-Trump in most of the states around the country. I think Tennessee is just one example.
Now, we're going to take another break, and when I return, I want you to talk about evangelical politics and just some of the activities that you were engaged in the last election.
There are speakers, and then there are great speakers who know the importance of creating that memorable moment. Well, the key to any successful event is an informative and inspirational speaker. Professor Dr. Carol Swain is that gifted speaker. She delivers passionately from the heart every time. To find out more about booking Carol for your next great event, simply go to carolmswain.com. Click on Public Speaking and then click the blue Book Carol tab.
I'm back with my guest, Steve Gill. We're talking presidential politics. And Steve, I know that last election, you were very active with evangelical politics, and we know that certainly among white evangelicals that there has been much support of the president.
Yeah, the previous couple of election cycles, 17 million Christian evangelical voters had stayed home, had not voted. And in those two elections that Barack Obama won, the difference, particularly in battleground states, could have been made by evangelical voters voting their faith and turning out to vote. We saw a change in 2016, and we launched an effort to try and get evangelical voters to turn out and vote through our Lift the Vote effort. Folks can go to Lift the Vote on Facebook, go to liftthevote.org and find out more about what we've done and what we plan to do in this new election cycle. But the idea was to go out and engage voters and ask them to pray, discern, and to vote their faith. We weren't telling them to vote Republican, to vote Democrat, to vote for President Trump, or to vote for Hillary Clinton. We felt that if people would look at the issues that mattered to them, which was making sure that conservative justices got appointed and confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court, that religious liberty was protected, that the unborn lives were protected in this country, that if Christian voters voted on the issues that mattered to them in alignment with those issues, then they would, we felt, come to the right decision. And I think one of the reasons that President Trump won was because Christian evangelical voters turned out in bigger numbers. We mentioned earlier that Catholic voters, particularly those pro-life Catholic voters in battleground states like Ohio and Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, that they were particularly critical to the margin that President Trump got in those states that carried those electoral votes in his favor. I believe that the key in the 2020 reelection effort, and we're going to be going out again trying to, with hand-to-hand combat, actually going and engaging people. We put 400,000 I'm a Christian, I'm voting stickers on people in six battleground states in 2016. We're going to redouble our efforts in 2020 and seek to turn out those Christian voters by going in and engaging them personally, directly, and we're going to be seeking volunteers. We're going to be seeking assistance and help and people sharing the word. And again, that starts by going and liking us on Facebook at Lift the Vote and going to our website at liftthevote.org and finding out how you can get involved in the 16, 17 or so battleground states that are going to make a difference. And those evangelical voters, those Catholic voters, white, black, Asian, Hispanic voters of faith, that's going to be the difference both in this election and in putting our country back on the right track. 2 Chronicles 7:14 says, if my people who are called by my name, which means us Christians, will humble ourselves, repent, and seek the face of God, he will hear our prayers and heal our land. It's on us as Christians to do it, and we've not been doing our job in past election cycles or in fighting for faith in our daily lives and in the policy issues that affect our country.
I agree 100% with you, and we will post on the with this podcast the information about your website and how people can become involved with Lift the Vote. One of the things I wanted to ask you, Steve, is what percentage of the evangelicals in America are registered to vote? Are you running into a situation where You may be putting stickers on people, but maybe those people are not registered.
You know, the good news is that it's become easier than ever to register to vote. The problem that we've had in most of these states, because you can register online, you almost automatically, when you get a driver's license or other engagement with government, have an easy opportunity to register. And again, in most states, you can even go and register to vote online. Our problem has been getting people, you know, out of the pews and to the polls, getting them to actually go and vote. It hadn't been a real problem of, are you registered? It's been a, will you turn out and vote? And it's particularly important in off-year elections. For example, this year, Virginia is having their state house and state senate races, an off-year election where, again, that Christian evangelical vote is even lower than it is in presidential years or in years when they've got governor's races that are on the ballot to turn people out. It is important for people to turn out in the states that are having off-year elections this year, like Mississippi, New Jersey, and Virginia, to turn out and vote their Christian faith this year in these state house and state senate races. In Virginia, 2 years ago, the Democrats picked up a swing of about 15 seats in the state house. One state house election was literally a dead tie and was determined by the flip of a coin. The Republicans in that race won by a coin flip, and that is the reason that Republicans in Virginia have a one-seat majority in the state house. A dead tie and a coin flip kept the House of Delegates in Virginia in Republican hands. This year, we've got an opportunity to maybe swing that pendulum back another 10 or 15 seats, give a little more breathing room to prevent stuff like the infanticide attempt that Governor Northam, the black-faced governor, had put into place and was even advocating for the murder of born babies.
Yes.
After they're born, not even until the moments before birth. And the way you reverse that is to reverse that trend, which means Christian evangelicals in Virginia need to turn out this November to put people of faith back in power in Virginia.
They really do. And I was born and raised in Virginia, and it is a fascinating state. It was one of the states that led the massive resistance to integration. And it doesn't surprise me that there's been so much racism coming from my home state.
And Governor Northam is still in power. And the lieutenant governor, who also, you know, dressed in blackface and engaged in the same behavior, he's still the lieutenant governor, or still the attorney general. And then you have the lieutenant governor, an African-American, who's been credibly accused by two women of rape, and they haven't removed him.
It doesn't matter if you're a Democrat.
Virginia politics is disgusting.
It doesn't matter if you're a Democrat accused of abusing women. They seem to have, they get a free pass on that.
Yeah, you got to believe the woman, unless the woman is accusing a Democrat. And we're seeing that, you know, again, in Tennessee right now. There's a state representative who has some allegations from 30 years ago from some women in his community. No complaint was ever made. No charges were ever made. The Democrats are trying to force him out of the state legislature, while you have a black legislator from Knoxville, Representative Rick Staples, who's been accused by at least one or two women while he's in the legislature recently of groping them, and he's still in the legislature, and there's no attempt by the Democrats to remove him. So the Democrats would have no standards, Carol, if they didn't have double standards.
I agree 100% with that. In the final moments of this interview, what can you tell us about Tennessee?
I think Tennessee is going to be a state to keep an eye on next year. Lamar Alexander has decided not to seek re-election to the U.S. Senate. And there's kind of a waiting game going on of whether or not Bill Haslam, the former governor, spent 8 years as governor, previously 8 years as mayor of Knoxville, Tennessee, whether moderate Governor Bill Haslam will run or not. Now, Bill Haslam, as governor, pushed the expansion of Obamacare not once but twice, was an advocate of Common Core, raised taxes $300 million a year in gas taxes, despite Tennessee having a billion to $2 billion surplus. He was a never-Trumper who just 3 weeks before the election said he would not vote for President Trump as president, and urged him to withdraw as the nominee 3 weeks before the election, an election that here in Tennessee saw President Trump carry 92 out of 95 counties, win over Hillary Clinton by over 20 points. And yet Governor Bill Haslam, as a Republican, was and remains a never-Trumper. Just this week, as we're taping this He is bringing Ben Sasse, an adamant never-Trumper, to Tennessee to raise money for him in his Senate race. And Ben Sasse is one of those who contemplated running against President Trump in the presidential race in this coming cycle, and has said he thinks every day about leaving the Republican Party. So that's who Bill Haslam, as a never-Trumper, is supporting, despite the fact that Tennessee is an 87.7% approval rating among Republicans for President Trump. So we're waiting to see if Haslam runs. If Haslam does, there's a congressman, Mark Green, a conservative congressman, who may run against him and I think would have an excellent chance against him. If Haslam doesn't run, I think you have probably four or five candidates that would probably still include Congressman Mark Green running in that race. So Tennessee is going to be a place where we're either going to see a conservative who wants to support President Trump, like Senator Marsha Blackburn, who we elected last year. We're either going to send somebody in the vein of Marsha Blackburn, or we're going to send another never-Trumper like a Mitt Romney, like a Jeff Flake, like a Ben Sasse, like a Bob Corker, to try and block what President Trump is doing rather than trying to assist him. And hopefully Tennessee will make the right choice.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for your insights, and I hope to have you back on the show again.
Look forward to it. And in the meantime, I encourage folks to go check out TennesseeStar.com, TheOhioStar.com, and our newest edition, TheMinnesotaSun.com, where we'll keep folks up to date on what's happening in those battleground states.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Carol.
Well, you've heard it. You've heard Steve's take on the presidential politics. And there's so much for us to be mulling over and also getting fired up about when it comes to next year. And as always, I remind you to be the people who stand up and take back your nation. Until next time.